Is transition away from fossil fuels toward a renewable global economy based on hydropower, solar, and wind power feasible? How could free trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP compromise Canada's energy security? Does the very existence of the U.S. military-industrial complex and imperialism put to rest any hope of preventing or mitigating climate collapse? Does the prospect of near-term human extinction due to climate change make resistance futile? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we speak to two eminent energy experts and book authors, Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute and Gordon Laxer, founder and former director of the Parklands Institute, about practical strategies for addressing the twin crises of peak oil and climate change. We then hear back from evolutionary biologist Guy McPherson about responses in the faces of an unavoidable calamity facing humanity. On this week's program, Peak Oil and Climate Collapse. Can society make the transition in time? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 3rd, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The objective of the coup d'etat was to deny Brazil's sovereignty in the formulation of macroeconomic policy to hunt its quote-unquote independence. Under Dilma, the tradition of selecting a Wall Street fox had been abandoned with the appointment of Alexandre Antonio Tombini, a career government official who headed the Central Bank of Brazil from 2011 to May 2016. Upon Michel Temer's accession as interim president, Henrique Campos de Meirel was appointed to head the Ministry of Finance. In turn, Meirel appointed his own cronies to head the Central Bank and the Banco do Brasil. Meirel was described by the U.S. media as, quote-unquote, market-friendly. That comes from the article Wall Street Behind Brazil Coup d'Etat by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted June 1st. One can surely argue that the Obama administration on the whole was less bad than the previous Bush-Cheney administration, both domestically and internationally. However, because elected presidential candidate Barack Obama arrived at the White House without any administrative experience and without having his own brain trust and seemingly without having a clear plan on how to implement his lofty promises, he had to submit himself to the same neocon advisors and warmongering interventionists who were omnipresent in the previous administration. He ended up reacting rather than acting, following rather than leading. That is why the Obama administration's policies, especially foreign policy, with a few notable exceptions, did not diverge appreciably from those imperial policies pursued by the previous Bush-Cheney administrations. President Barack Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, has failed to live up to the promises he made and the hopes he raised. That comes from the article, Barack Obama's Meager Legacy, Incomplete Accomplishments and Provoked Wars, What Happened, by Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, posted June 1st. The reason that the CIA began torturing prisoners is that the CIA's leadership was obsessed with the idea that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden would launch another attack against the United States. Bin Laden said this attack would come, and the CIA's leadership was ready to do anything to stop it. As a result, the CIA began a torture program to try to collect that information. They also created a system of secret prisons, and most prisoners eventually were sent to Guantanamo. That was an excerpt from an interview with John Kiriakou, by Edu Montesanti under the headline, "An ex-CIA agent blows the whistle on torture and secret prisons," posted June 2nd. Israel Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan has dipped into the discourse of censorship to convince others that limiting various social media platforms on a global scale is the way to go. In January, he revealed the inner ambition of Israel's security establishment to internationalize the censorship effort. To achieve that goal, Erdan speaks of an international coalition that would make limiting criticism of Israel its primary objective. The central aim is hardly imaginative, making such providers as YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook face up to responsibility as to what they host on their sites. The Erdan plan suggests that various countries would form a, quote, loose coalition that would keep an eye on content and where it is being posted, and members of the coalition would work to demand that the platforms remove the content that was posted in any of their countries at the request of members, unquote. That comes from the article Dreams of Control, Israel, Global Censorship, and the Internet by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted June 2nd. In its annual report on the state of Black America, one of the oldest research organizations in the African American community documents the continuing levels of national oppression and economic exploitation. This report for 2016 represents the 40th anniversary of the yearly study, with the first issued in 1976, released under the title Locked Out: Education, Jobs, and Justice, A Message to the Next President. The document provides more than enough evidence to suggest that the African American people remain an oppressed nation within the political and economic clutches of Washington and Wall Street. Despite the advent of the first African American president in the personage of Barack Hussein Obama, the fundamental problems facing this population of at least 45 million are still unresolved some 151 years since the abolition of chattel slavery and the conclusion of the Civil War. That comes from the article State of Black America. National Urban League report says African Americans remain locked out by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Climate collapse and peak oil and gas are the two horns of human civilization's global energy dilemma. There are now daunting signs that increasing concentrations of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere is generating droughts, wildfires, acidification of our oceans, and a rapid die-off of species. Meanwhile, it is now well established that conventional oil production peaked back in 2005, and for the last decade, environmentally destructive techniques like hydraulic fracturing and the mining of bitumen sands and shale oil has exploded the generation of a temporary glut on the market. Dependence on these finite fuels presents humanity with a challenge no politician or community member can afford to ignore. The question is, how can one rationally respond? Transition would seem to be the way to go, but is it feasible and workable? Is it enough to avert disaster? And what would it look like? Joining me to address these questions are two eminent energy experts. Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, a journalist and author of a dozen books, including The Party's Over, Oil, Water, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and his most recent, Afterburns, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. Heinberg is considered one of the world's leading educators on the subject of peak oil, the opposite side of the fossil fuel energy coin. He's also an avid amateur violinist. And he joins us from California. And joining us here in the CKUW studio is Gordon Laxer, political economist and former head and founding director of the Parkland Institute based at the University of Alberta, where he is professor emeritus. He's widely published in newspapers and magazines and the author of several books, including Open for Business, The Roots of Foreign Ownership in Canada, and his most recent, After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians. So, Professor Laxer and Mr. Heinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Okay, so on the topic of this, the concept of renewable, the renewable economy, I know that there's a Stanford University professor named Mark Jacobson who's written that a 100% renewable economy for the planet built on hydropower, solar, and wind is theoretically achievable by 2030. I know that you know, in your work, Gordon Lax, you spoke at least with the, within the Canadian context about the feasibility of transition. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about you know, the complications involved in achieving this a renewable economy in that short a time frame.
Well, I think it would be difficult to achieve it by 2030. And I like the term renewable economy rather than just renewable energy, because we're going to have to get there a lot through conservation. We waste so much energy in this country. Norway and Sweden are equally cold, small populated, big countries. They use way less carbon energy than we do. And so I think that's a huge part of the solution. We also have to think in getting to a renewable economy, we have to think about jobs for those who are involved in the present carbon fuel exporting economy. The Canada's a huge part of our economy. So, for example, last year in the Alberta Sands, about 50,000 workers were laid off because the price of oil makes it uneconomic, really, to produce oil there. There were 17 projects canceled in the sands last year, and that was almost half the oil projects canceled in the world. What we should be doing is offering the majority of those workers were construction workers. We should be offering them jobs in the transition. So, you know, constructing high-speed trains, Edmonton to Calgary, or, you know, Windsor, Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, retrofitting all buildings, building LRT, all of those kinds of things. So that there actually are more jobs in saving a unit of carbon energy than in actually finding it, burning it, and emitting it. And it's very important to talk about that, because there will be incredible resistance to the change unless we can offer people an alternative. But, you know, we're going to actually have to consume less stuff. But this isn't a sacrifice, though. We have to, you know, present this as something that is positive. You're going to have more free time. This isn't, buying more stuff isn't what makes you happier. We're going to have to be talking in that kind of way.
Richard Heinberg, I know that you've pointed out that one way or the other, we're going to have to transition. So what are your thoughts about the feasibility of a global renewable economy and the complications?
Well, actually, I've just co-authored a book on this subject called Our Renewable Future, co-authored with David Fridley, who's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. And we looked at the prospects for a 100% renewable energy transition, not only in terms of energy supply, but also in terms of the ways we use energy. One of the big hurdles is the fact that wind, solar, and hydro produce electricity, but only about 20% of our energy is consumed in the form of electricity. So that means the other 80%, which is used in transportation, in buildings for heating and air conditioning and so on, well, mostly heating, and in industrial processes, we have to find ways to electrify all of that energy usage. And in some cases, there are going to be significant challenges. Just a couple that we identified are cement production. Cement, of course, is the main ingredient in concrete, which is in turn, you know, really the foundation, literally the foundation of modern industrial societies. So we probably could produce cement without fossil fuels. The cement production process is a very high heat process, about 1,500 1,500 degrees Celsius. We could produce those high levels of heat without using fossil fuels, theoretically, but there are no pilot projects, and we have no idea how much it would cost to do it. Another hurdle is the aviation sector. Mark Jacobson proposes using cryogenic hydrogen, or supercooled hydrogen, as a replacement for kerosene jet fuels. Well, again, this is theoretically possible, but we don't have any hydrogen-burning airplanes. They would look entirely different. They would have to be completely re-engineered from the ground up. And would that cryogenic hydrogen be affordable? There are lots of reasons for thinking that it would be actually quite a lot more expensive than current jet fuels. So again, those are just a couple of examples. As Gordon was saying, it's not just a matter of unplugging the coal power plant and plugging in a solar panel. Really, our whole way of life is going to change as we move to renewable energy. Our whole economy will change.
I know that, well, Gordon, you were just talking just now about some of the resistance, the pushback, and I'm thinking, the role of these entrenched entities, big oil, and we hear about the Koch brothers who are financing climate denialism and getting that out in the public realm. And you've also mentioned things about the trade deals which have been signed, which guarantee that even if you had a country or a community that wanted to preserve or transition or whatever, then that just means they're still going to keep exporting to the other country, in the case of NAFTA, exports to the United States. So I'm wondering if you wanted to say a little bit more about that the role of these elite entrenched interests in becoming obstacles to achieving that renewable economy.
Yes. Well, they're called free trade agreements, but basically they're corporate rights agreements. And they're about the right of entry of corporations into whatever country has signed these. New trade deals like the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, will make it much more difficult for governments to regulate the environment and corporations can sue. These are really the wrong way to go. In particular, Canada is in a very peculiar position with NAFTA. There's the Energy Proportionality Clause, which most Canadians have never heard of. But basically, it only really applies to Canada. And it says that Canada, even if we have energy shortages here, we must export the same percentage of energy to the United States as we do now. So that's about 70% of our oil, over half of our natural gas. It doesn't apply to Mexico because Mexico said, no, we're not going to sign that. We give up our sovereignty. So that Mexico has an exemption. It doesn't apply much to the United States either because the United States is still an importer of oil. And even with the shale and fracturing and horizontal drilling revolution, it is still going to be importing oil something like a quarter to a third between now and 2035. And the United States wants to get off importing oil from the Middle East and from Venezuela, so they're going to continue to want to have Canadian oil. The problem with us in terms of the environment is that how can we control our own emissions if we have to produce almost an unlimited amount of energy for export? And the fastest growing source of emissions in Canada is actually from the production of oil and gas, most of which is for export. That's actually higher than the emissions that come from transportation in Canada. So, what I'd like to see us do, the Alberta's got a plan to get off coal-fired electricity generation by 2030. I'd like to see Canada, in the same time frame, phase out Alberta sands. They can't be greened. And to phase out carbon fuel exports. We have about the same amount of conventional non-fracked oil in Canada as Canadians consume. We should be transitioning to that. And as that declines, we have to cut oil use at least as quickly.
Yeah, Richard Heinberg, I mean, Professor Laxer is bringing up an important point about, you know, whatever ambitions we might have in terms of, like, within a nation or community, there are these agreements that we're binding, whether it's NAFTA or TPP or the World Trade Organization or whatever, that tie the hands of political leadership. So, I mean, is that something that can be just easily shrugged off?
Well, I think governments can rescind those agreements. If governments can make the agreements, they can rescind them. Whatever the penalties might be, they would certainly be, in the end, a better outcome than continuing with these agreements.
Of course, that also means that you're having to stand up to major, I mean, at least the way the modern countries work, you have these what you call special interests or corporate interests that are going to be using every trick in the book to, you propagandize the population through mainstream media and other messaging, lobbying politicians that would make it difficult.
Of course. But these agreements are inherently unpopular anyway. And I think one of the messages we're seeing from the current U.S. election is that people are really fed up with the globalist agenda. They've seen jobs disappear. They've seen their environment wrecked. And it just doesn't make sense. And here in the U.S., it's been both Democrats and Republicans pushing this agenda for the last several decades. And I think the message of both Donald Trump, regardless of how regardless of the messenger, and also of Bernie Sanders, is, you know, enough is enough.
Hmm. Although you mentioned Donald Trump, and as I understand it, Mr. Trump has who has a good chance of becoming the next president, had named Representative Kevin Cramer from North Dakota as his energy advisor. And Cramer is not only a climate skeptic, but one of the leading oil and gas drilling advocates in the United States, from a state that's on the front lines of the U.S. shale oil and gas boom. So, I mean, that suggests that whatever he might say on the campaign trail, that ends up being executed is going to go very much against what the people think that they're voting for.
Right. Well, the trade deals are somewhat different subject than energy policy. Perhaps less so for Canada, because with Canada we're talking about mostly energy exports. But in terms of climate and energy policy, I think you're absolutely right. All of the statements that Trump has made suggest that he doesn't understand energy, and certainly doesn't understand climate.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned this idea that I think people would like to see that it seems to be an increasing sense in a lot of messaging about the need to move to a renewable economy and to, you know, policies that are, you know, friendly to the climate and moving us, transitioning us. But I don't know if they really necessarily know what they're in for, because the ways in which our lives would have to be changed. You mentioned about the airplanes, not being able to fly around quite as much. The fact that we are civilization as we understand it is still heavily dependent on so many things beyond electricity, mining and agriculture, and it appears that it's going to be hard to do a lot of those things without fossil fuels. So in practical terms, what is that going to mean, like, to people's everyday lives? Gordon, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I don't think we know exactly how it's going to unfold. We have to set up we have to first make a commitment to get there and to do it quickly over the next three decades or so, and we have to then set up a framework which is going to get us there. We need a framework which is going to tilt the marketplace in favor of people buying renewables and using conservation rather than carbon fuels. But there has to be a lot of public support. If people are going to get out of their cars, you have to have good transit. You have to have cycling. You have to have walkable suburbs. You have to have densified cities, intercity, high-speed intercity rail. You can't just say, okay, you know, this is an individual decision. People just have to get out of their cars. But there is going to have to be a cultural revolution as well. I mean, I know people who won't even walk a block. They will get in their car to drive a block. And, you know, it's incredibly unhealthy to be living like that if you're able-bodied. So we also need a cultural shift. We need people to really recognize what we're in. And this is, these kind of discussions that we're having here is, trying to initiate that kind of thing.
Mm. Richard, I mean, for that matter, you mentioned that the amount of the energy required for the formation of concrete. And I'm wondering, because you've in your writing, you've talked about how much our whole way of life has been centered around this reality. Our economy is centered around this idea of all the huge amount of energy we get from oil and natural gas. And, one wonders if even cities as we know it would enter into a kind of a transition. Would people be living more on the land? How do you envision, a post-carbon world beyond the, lack of pollution and whatnot?
Right. Well, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. There's a lot that we can do right now to reduce our use of fossil fuels. I think taking coal out of the electricity mix is something that could be done immediately with the technology that we have, just replacing coal with solar, wind, geothermal, and so on. And we're not talking about going cold turkey immediately. We'll still be using fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. Right now, the way we produce PV solar panels and wind turbines, all of those industrial processes use fossil fuels. So we're going to increasingly have to do a kind of triage where we look at what are the most important societal uses for fossil fuels, whether it's producing renewable energy infrastructure or agriculture or what have you, and dedicating our remaining fossil fuel usage to those purposes and curtailing use of fossil fuels for things that can either be replaced or simply done without. In the process, I think what we really need to do, and this is something that's very hard for policymakers to even think about, much less talk about, is reconsider economic growth. Because as we make this energy transition, it'll be one thing to maintain an economy that supplies people's basic needs. It's something altogether different to imagine that we can continue the scale and the rate of growth that we saw over the last quarter of the 20th century. And of course, that's what all politicians want to be able to promise to their constituents, that we're going to have an ever-expanding economy, more roads, more cars, cheaper consumer goods, and so on. Realistically, that's just not in the cards. And I would say the same is true even if we don't attempt the energy transition one way or another. The economic growth that we saw in the late 20th century is pretty much over. So the question is, how do we deal with that? And I think being honest about it is a first step. And then the second step has got to be to make a realistic plan to get off of fossil fuels and engineer, design, and build an economy that is truly sustainable.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Now, I suspect that the elites, particularly within the United States, but through much of the world, would have a tough time being convinced because the trajectory so far, as stated by what's called the Carter Doctrine, is the necessity, the strategic importance of oil. And so you have a whole military-industrial complex directed toward control of oil. I think a lot, most of our listeners, at least, are most likely of the view that the Iraq War, for example, was all about oil. And I just happen to have a statistic. This is from the Oil Change International Report cited in The Guardian from December of last year. The Iraq War was responsible for 141 million tons of carbon releases in the first 4 years. On an annual basis, this was more than the emissions from 139 countries in this period, or about the same as putting an extra 25 million cars onto U.S. roads for a year. And the paper found that projected U.S. spending on the Iraq War would cover all global investments in renewable energy needed to halt global warming trends in the period to 2030. So are we basically – I mean, does this basically leave us in the position of having no choice but to confront and dismantle the U.S. Department of Defense, the Department of the U.S. military-industrial complex?
Right. Well, you know, in the military itself, there are a lot of people who would prefer not to be engaged in these operations. I think where you see the entrenched interests are among the arms manufacturers, who, of course, are making money hand over fist as these weapons are manufactured and used, and then the foreign policy establishment in Washington, the so-called neoconservatives, who seem to have a grip on power regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democratic administration. These people really are the ones responsible for the belligerent nature of U.S. foreign policy over the last decade and a half, and these folks need to go. I mean, they are really putting us all at risk in terms of their policies, not only in the Middle East, but also with Russia and China. We need a complete about-face in terms of foreign policy in Washington. And, you know, I don't see that happening until there's much more of an upwelling of public outcry about this.
Gordon Laxer, as in a previous interview, you talked about these North American integration initiatives and how energy security for Canada and energy security in the United States are not necessarily one and the same. And so, given the amount of energy that's used, at least you know currently by the U.S. Pentagon, what responsibility would you say we have? Can we do anything to mitigate or challenge the U.S. agenda?
Well, yeah, when Washington talks about official Washington talks about energy security, they often are talking about finding oil under someone else's sands. In Canada, that's because the United States is an empire and is looking for resources elsewhere and to control them. Because Canada is an energy satellite of the United States, when we talk about energy security, we're talking actually energy sovereignty for Canadians. So it's very different, just regaining control of our own resources so that we can use them in a different way and also for Canadians' basic needs. We have to think of access to energy as a basic amount of energy as a human right as we move to a lower energy kind of society. But Canada, you know, Canada can play as a middle power a role in trying to reduce the Western countries' alliance, you know, aggression in other countries. Canada could take a leadership in that and try and make alliances with other countries and also make alliances with the more progressive part of the U.S. Public opinion and political leaders. Canada could play an important role in that. I mean, the bigger job would be within the United States itself, but Canada is not a total bit player.
You know, I see a lot of people, they really do in the end appreciate imperialism. They just don't want to confront it. So, I mean, everybody who carries around one of these smartphones should be thanking exploited coltan miners in the Congo. Is it politically sellable to ask people to, you know, they're going to have to lower their expectations and not consume as much as Richard was explaining earlier? Is that feasible?
Well, it's going to change. It's going to we need a cultural revolution about this. I mean, you know, for most of my life, I've been fighting for more stuff for the poor, making sure that people have necessities. But once people have the basics, you know, you have enough food to eat, you've got shelter, you've got clothing, you've got some amount of leisure time, we don't get happier by buying more and more stuff. We actually get our most of our pleasure from each other and from nature. And so we are going to have to move in that. One of the difficulties is that when there's been a shift away from high-paying jobs, you know, in manufacturing and a number of sectors, and people have been compensated, when people in lower income in Canada and the global north, by buying cheap products from the global south. So they go to Walmart and they save money and they spend less on food than they used to 30, 40 years ago. And this, you know, this is the compensation for them earning lower wages. We're going to have to, you know, move up to the $15 an hour minimum wage, have a livable wage. So there's going to have to be a whole shift. And, you know, we're going to have to move to a more locally provisioned and nationally provisioned economies and producing. And, you know, that every country is going to have to find their own solutions to their energy like they did before the Industrial Revolution. I'm not saying we're going to go back to that way of living, but I think that, you know, I think we're seeing a move away from the global economy.
Okay. Richard, the revolution?
Yeah, I totally agree, and Gordon just made most of the points that I was going to. Localization is in our future one way or another. Globalization was based on the kinds of trade agreements we were talking about earlier, but it was also based on cheap oil for shipping and for truck transport across long distances. As that cheap oil goes away, either as a result of smart climate policies or simply the process of inevitable depletion, one way or another, we are going to see less mobile economies, and that means more localized economies. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. We traded away a lot in terms of human rights and environmental sanity in order to promote globalization of production and trade. And as we move back toward more localized economies, we could see substantial benefits in terms of our you know, tangible way of life, our communities, this knowing who is producing our stuff. And you see that at farmers markets. People really like to engage with one another as producer consumers, rather than just buying something at the Walmart and having this this terrible feeling that it was probably produced in ways that you really don't want to know about, but you have no alternative. Moving toward a more localized economy is inevitable. It's just a question of whether we embrace the trend and optimize it, or let it overtake us in ways that are far from optimal.
One more point to raise, and I'm just going to quote some rather sobering statistics. This comes from the investigative journalist Dar Jamail, writing one of his weekly climate dispatches in Truth Out. He talks about NASA releasing data showing that the planet has just seen 7 straight months of not just record-breaking, but record-shattering heat. And the NASA data showing that April was the hottest April ever recorded, as well as the fact that it crushed the previous April record by the largest margin of increase increase ever recorded, making this 3 months in a row the monthly record has been broken, and easily. Also mentions that the Arctic without summer sea ice could happen as early as this September, a turn of events that would have serious implications for global climate patterns, a loss of sea ice even outpacing the worst-case modeling predictions. And also, according to a recent press release from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, a reduction in the amount of dissolved oxygen in the oceans due to abrupt climate disruption is already happening and will become widespread by before 2040. And one more study recently released by the UK-based Christian charity Christian Aid projected over 1 billion people at risk from coastal flooding by 2060, with the populations of China, India, and the United States being the most heavily impacted. So I am just going to ask the two of you a question. Is this too late? You know, the transition, is it too little too late? Have we reached the tipping point? Are we looking at the near-term extinction of our species?
Maybe I'll go first. No one knows how close we are to a irreversible tipping point. I think those who say that near-term extinction is more or less inevitable at this point are exaggerating an interpretation of the data. Very few climate scientists would agree with that assessment. Nevertheless, the trends that you talked about are extremely serious. There's no question about it. We have set in motion some self-reinforcing feedback mechanisms, such as the melting of the Arctic permafrost, especially in Siberia, releasing enormous amounts of methane, much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And that's why we're seeing these extraordinary temperature records being set month after month. That's why we need to take climate very seriously, not only in terms of reducing our fossil fuel usage, but also in terms of changing our agricultural practices so that we're building topsoil rather than destroying it, because by building topsoil, we're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it in the safest and most useful place it could possibly go. Reforestation, it's very clear that we could capture and sequester very significant, globally significant amounts of carbon if we took these matters seriously. So it's not just a matter of stopping doing the bad things. We could actually transform our civilization in ways that would prevent the worst of climate change while giving us a safer and healthier food system.
So Gordon Laxer, I mean, this is. I know there's a saying that opportunity and catastrophe are kind of like opposite sides of the same coin. What are your thoughts on the subject of our dire future prospects?
Yes, I mean, I lived in Alberta for 31 years. Edmonton is the closest big city to Fort McMurray, where there was this awful wildfires and 90,000 people had to evacuate. These are really climate change refugees. And this kind of thing, it's hard to attribute one fire to global warming, but there are twice as many, the area of forest fires is twice as much as it was in the 1970s, and is predicted to either double or triple in the next 3 or 4 decades if global warming continues in its present path. And it's when you see something like that in China, when you can't breathe in the cities, if these things, disasters actually brought home to people that we have to do something, that's important. But it's also important that, in Canada, I think there's less of the climate denial thing that we've seen. Maybe it's stronger in the United States. It's still fairly strong in Alberta. But I think we're into a kind of solutions denial. A lot of people, the majority of Canadians actually get, you know, they say, yes, we have to do something about climate change, but they don't see that there is a solution that's possible. And it's important that we actually start to build roadmaps, to do more work, to get out and talk to people and say, yes, these are feasible roads, and this can be a better future than we have now. It's very important that we do that and to dispel the worries that people have in making that transition. And also, when I talked about jobs, that is one of the more scary things. I mean, people are going to hang on to the job they have rather than some job you promise them that isn't there yet. So we have to really develop a really viable transition policy.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid that we're now out of time, but Gordon Laxer, Richard Heinberg, I've very much enjoyed this discussion, although, you know, for the some of the negative aspects to it. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Great to be here.
Richard Heinberg, senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute and author of Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, among other books. And Gordon Laxer is a political economist and the former head and founding director of the Parkland Institute and author of After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians. We're joined now by Guy McPherson. He is the Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He spent years assembling and collating available peer-reviewed research on climate. And on his blog, Nature Bats Last, there's a monster climate essay which leaves readers with the conclusion that there's virtually nothing that can be done to halt runaway climate change and the near-term extinction of the human species. And he joins us from southern New Mexico. Thank you for joining us once again, Guy McPherson.
Thank you for the opportunity, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, so you're joining us now. We're talking about responses to the climate, the twin crises of peak oil and gas and climate change. And we'd mentioned the issue of near-term human extinction previously with two previous guests, and one of them has basically said that while he acknowledges there's a lot of concerns, he seems to feel that there's when it comes to near-term human extinction, that there's an exaggeration of an interpretation of the data that very few climate scientists agree with. I wanted to give you an opportunity to express why you believe there is a that the near-term human extinction is very much on the table, in fact, locked in.
Well, we've triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback loops. Or quote, positive feedbacks on the climate front, including firing the clathrate gun from the Arctic Ocean. So that's methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean into the atmosphere. Methane has gone exponential in the atmosphere, as has carbon dioxide. And then there's the issue of solar dimming or global dimming. If we stop putting particulates up into the atmosphere, particulates other than greenhouse gases, things like aerosols and sulfate from burning low-quality coal. If we stop doing that, all those particulates fall out of the sky in a very short period of time and cause an abrupt rise in temperature. I suspect beyond which the human species can persist, and certainly with the rapidity of that increase in global average temperature, it would be difficult for the other species we depend upon to adapt in time. And that's not even including the self-reinforcing feedback loops. Two of the fast ones include methane from the shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean and moistening of the upper troposphere. As the planet gets hotter, it gets moister too. And most of that moisture ends up in the upper troposphere, more than 90% of it, between 8,000 and 13,000 meters above the surface of the Earth. And as the moisture goes up there, it serves as a greenhouse gas. Water vapor is the most abundant of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And it causes more heating. And more heating means more moisture in the atmosphere. And more moisture in the atmosphere means more heating. So it's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. You put together a few of these self-reinforcing feedback loops, even just the couple that we have predictions about the timing for, and coming to you using even a relatively conservative approach, it's difficult for me to imagine a situation in which we avoid the temperature, 22 degrees Celsius, at which the planet has spent most of its time in the last 2 billion years, in the very near future. And I'm not going to put a date on that, but it seems we're headed for 22 degrees Celsius plus or minus a degree based on the fast feedbacks. And so what that means is not decades and certainly not centuries, but rather months or years from now, we could be facing temperatures characterized by the dinosaurs, for example. And it's really, really difficult for me to imagine a situation in which all the other species on the planet are able to keep up with that kind of change. It's far more rapid than the Great Dying of 252 million years ago, for example, when more than 90% of the species on the planet went extinct.
So in that case, no matter what we do at this point, I mean, when we talk about the renewable economy, I mean, you mentioned about global dimming, and I suppose if we're able to completely wean ourselves off of these fossil fuels, that gets rid of the dimming problem in the sense that the dimming disappears at the same time, and then you're dealing with a situation that inviting the collapse even faster. But is there anything else about the renewable economy that you think is maybe misguided or naive?
Well, it essentially allows relatively privileged folks, mostly in the global north, to keep doing what we've been doing that I would argue has not been working for a lot of other species and a lot of other cultures on the planet. So based on a report from the United Nations, August 2010, we're driving an estimated 150 to 200 species to extinction every day, and that's rooted in industrial civilization. We depend upon many of those species for our own continued persistence on the planet. And switching to any other energy sources that allow us to keep doing the same flawed strategy seems like a bad idea to me. And never mind the other consequences of civilization, particularly industrial civilization, including, for example, disparity in wealth, disparity in income, which is, as I understand it, never been greater than it is right now, and the fouling of the air and the dirtying of the water and the washing the soil into the ocean, and, you know, the list goes on. Do we really want to keep doing things the same way and just assuming that the children will adapt? It seems a little short-sighted to me.
Hmm. That being said, though, I mean, even if our we can still make changes. It's just that they may not be indicated earlier. Maybe it's just too little, too late. But I mean, you can, for example, I know that you individually have altered your you haven't decided to say, oh, what the heck, and just become.
No. I'm a huge fan of taking action, and I have never proposed inaction in response to the myriad predicaments we face. And so it was more than 7 years ago that I left my high-pay, low-work job at the University of Arizona. I was actually banned from teaching in my home department, so I was paid to not show up. And I left that position to establish an off-grid homestead in southern New Mexico. So I use solar panels to provide electricity and also to power the pumps that get the water out of the ground. And so I've never proposed inaction. In fact, I'm the poster child of the kind of person who should not have concluded near-term human extinction as a result of climate change or any other means, because I took this profound action to plan for the twin sides of the fossil fuel coin, peak oil and consequent decline of civilization, and also climate change. So this homestead is the product of a three-year search for the place to land, and I was keeping in mind relatively slow climate change and also peak oil. And here we are in the midst of abrupt climate change, and we're finding out every day a bunch of information that we weren't privy to 7-plus years ago when I left the university, and about 9 years ago when I made the decision.
And over that time, have you have you learned any lessons or possibly had any disappointments or anything else that you might want to share with listeners?
Well, yes, of course, it's very disappointing to give up a position such as the one I had and conclude in retrospect that I could have been working not very hard and making quite a lot of money and probably had a larger voice than I do now on various topics. Many mistakes. In fact, I try to make all my mistakes many times just so I learn from the experience, because they say you learn from your mistakes. I'm not going to go down that road here, but probably the most important thing I've learned is the community, the human community that one finds oneself within is absolutely fundamentally important to one's well-being. So we talk a lot about other characteristics of habitat, such as food and water and the ability to keep our body temperature at a safe level. But I would argue that more important than all of those is the people with whom we spend our time.
Hmm. And just, I guess, on a concluding note then, I know you've spoken about the need to face our these twin crises, predicaments, as someone in hospice, as a human species is in hospice. That doesn't necessarily mean that we give up.
No, that's absolutely right. It means living more fully every day. It means accepting the fact that we all get to live, and therefore that we all get to or have to die, depending upon your perspective. And so living with some sense of urgency, I think, is paramount here. And I think that's the case regardless of whether we're knowledgeable about these predicaments or not. Consider, for example, the world's oldest human being turned 117 years old in March of 2015. And in response to the question, what was that like? You know, how would you consider those first 117 years? She said, it seemed rather short. And then to put a punctuation on her message and mine, she died a couple of weeks later. So life is short. We should treat it with urgency.
Okay. Well, I very much appreciate your thoughts, as always, Guy McPherson, and I wish you well down there in the mud hut, and also on your speaking tour. It seems unending these days.
Yes, thank you very much, Michael. It's been quite a ride.
We've been joined by Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He is the host of the Nature Bats Last radio program on the Progressive Radio Network. And you can read more of his material at the website guymcpherson.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.